The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
Welcome to Squawk Box. Here are your headlines today. U.S. equities hit a record high ahead of key inflation data as a top Fed official waters down expectations for a rate cut anytime soon.
I'm going to need to see at least a couple of months of better inflation data before I have enough confidence that beginning to cut rates will keep the economy on a path to 2% inflation.
UBS cuts the negative goodwill from its rescue of Credit Suisse, leading to a hit of more than $1 billion to 2023's net profit, as the lender warns it might not be able to realize all of the expected gains. Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte downplays trade tensions in a high-stakes Beijing bilateral, telling Chinese President Xi Jinping that chip restrictions aren't targeted.
They are never aimed at one country specific. That you always try to make sure that the impact is limited, is not impacting the supply chain.
And the yen holds near its lowest level since 1990, with markets on high alert for any BOJ intervention after authorities hold an emergency meeting in Tokyo. We go into a long weekend with a lot of jaw-burning by officials. Christopher Waller yesterday setting out the case for perhaps a longer runway to getting towards those rate cuts. And don't forget, the market already primed thanks to Bostic earlier this week suggesting just one rate cut. Now, where Waller comes into the mix, don't forget this is a man with a lot of credibility over at the Fed. In recent years, he's been talking about the strength of the labour market and whether high rates for longer actually causes a spike in unemployment rate this time round, or whether just means you see a slowing in the pace of hiring by employers. And that's exactly what has played out. So again, back to the credibility of Waller, markets very much leaning into that commentary yesterday as to whether we now have some time frame to get through before we see those rate cuts because of the sticky inflation we've witnessed for the first couple of months this year. Markets yesterday, though, you've got to say, we're still seeing a lot of upside, 1.2 up on the Dow. Again, an element of strength, the breadth that's been coming back into these markets as we've been approaching the end of the quarter. We've seen it really enter into the equation versus the handful of stocks that investors have been trading early on in this market rally. 8/10 up on the S&P, the Nasdaq also in play up 0.5%, but a lot of numbers as we look to wrap up the quarter, up 10% for the likes of the S&P 500 for the trading quarter, for the likes of the Nasdaq, a rally of about 9.25%, Nvidia, one of the big names to play so far this year. I want to take you to Treasury markets. Don't forget, it's the PCE that we're going to be watching later on as we look to close out the week. The market looking for that number for confirmation that the core is starting to come down, that we're seeing the stickiness in inflation start to abate. That's going to be crucial for markets, and a lot of the action going to be happening when the markets are shut, don't forget. So 4.61 on the 2-year, the 10-year, 4.21 is what we're watching. I want to take you to the dollar. A lot of the action has been dollar strength thanks to this more hawkish commentary coming through from Fed officials this week. But the market, I think, at this stage fixated on dollar yen rates. You can see we've managed to slide off some of the weakness from yesterday. We were approaching the 152 handle. So 151.37. I mentioned the jawboning. We're hearing it from officials out of Japan about being ready to intervene. There was an emergency meeting yesterday, so traders not willing to test the mettle of Japanese officials at this stage. But long weekend coming, will we see thin liquidity and will we see some movement here if there isn't any actual action by authorities out of Japan? So that is the one to watch. But you can see tone on markets that it is a dollar strength story as euro and sterling both declined this morning. To the Asian markets and what we've got, Japanese stocks on the back foot. So giving back some territory after what has been another string of strength that we've seen for Tokyo stocks. We're above the 40,100 point mark, though, even with a decline of 1.5%. Real strength materializing across the rest of the boards. Hong Kong, China, don't forget there's been a very strong line from Chinese officials about being open to FDI, to investment from other companies overseas, other countries. That has now finally bolstered the market. We saw a little bit of a weakness cropping up despite some of that commentary yesterday. Australia trading high in lockstep with those markets. Mandy.
Thanks, Karen. Come and sit down, and we're going to just go through some lines that are coming out right now from UBS, where the CEO, Sergio Ermotti, apparently is open to extending his time at the helm of UBS to help oversee the integration of Credit Suisse. This is according to the letter published in the annual report, which we'll get onto in a second. Apparently, he said last September that he would remain as CEO until the end of 2026. Of course, this is, to oversee the integration process. Let me just run you through some of the other lines that are coming out of UBS here. And perhaps, Karen, you might want to weigh in as well, since you've been following this stock for a long time. They're going to be looking to increase their lending to the shipping sector and run off some loans to fossil fuel clients that they inherited from Credit Suisse. This is the biggest test yet of the impact of the mega merger on the sustainability commitments. Let me just go through some of the other things. Let's take a look at some of the numbers that are coming out here. Wade through some of the German headlines as well, since my German is really not what it should be.
compensation for Amotti, 14.4 million Swissy. Amotti joined back on the 5th of April, according to the annual report that we know, but the compensation for 2023, that is fresh coming through in the annual report. Total fixed and variable compensation for the group executive board, 140 million Swissy. That was up. We know it was a landmark year for them, but 106 was the starting point in 2022. So quite a big increase there. And that could be somewhat controversial, given the intervention of the state at one point to provide a safety net. The safety net then rolled back as the company itself was willing to step away from some of that state support. Mm-hmm. But that is quite an interesting number that's crossing.
Yeah, so the 2023 net profit, $27.8 billion, down from the 29 that was previously reported. They also say that their ability to successfully integrate Credit Suisse will depend on a number of factors. I guess that's always the case, including their ability. Just have a look at the headline here. Their ability to combine the operations of the two firms.
I think the major line today that Sergio Amotti is not willing to move away, that he's willing to stay around for longer. That's probably welcome news. Someone who's been a steady hand around this integration, what is a significant asset now for the Swiss, not just for the markets and for the banking system, but also for Switzerland as a country.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on here, because many Western markets are closed tomorrow, when we're going to be getting the latest look at the Fed's preferred PCE gauge of inflation. With the LSEG data indicating a slight uptick in the reading for February, it is expected to come in 2.5% higher on the year, that is versus January's 2.4% figure. That is only half a percentage point above the Fed's target, of course, but way down from the peak of 6.8% that we hit in June 2022. Money markets have settled in a probability of around two-thirds that the Fed will cut its rates at the June meeting. That's, of course, according to the CME's FedWatch tool. But not everyone on the FOMC sees rates coming down in the near future. Fed Governor Christopher Waller said in a speech on Wednesday that the central bank should push back the timing of a cut after February CPI data showed an uptick on the month.
In the absence of an unexpected and material deterioration in the real economy, I'm going to need to see at least a couple of months of better inflation data before I have enough confidence that beginning to cut rates will keep the economy on a path to 2% inflation. Wow.
Our next guest goes even further, saying the Fed is moving towards not cutting at all this year. I'm pleased to say we've got in studio with us Stephen Blitz, Chief U.S. Economist at T.S. Lombard. Great to see you in the studio. Normally it's down the line at some ungodly hour for you.
So. Yeah, I know. This is a much better ungodly hour than that.
Exactly.
Than one in the morning.
Bit of a lie-in over this side of the world.
Yes.
Let me ask you about the rate cutting, because the market's been disappointed all along. They thought it was, five rate cuts coming this year as they approach 2024. Not the case. They're happy with three. May not be three. What is the prospect that we get one or none?
Getting pretty good. You know, that 0.4% month over month is a high number. And, you know, so it's and they're looking at that. They're not just looking at year over year. They're looking at rolling three-month trends. And that number's starting to creep up. But here's the thing about the market. If you think about where the market was pricing Fed cuts in January, they've reduced those, right? And the January 2025 Fed funds target is about 80 basis points higher than it was at the beginning of the year, but the equity market is stronger, right? So really what's going on here is an evolution, right, where people are just seeing the economy strong, inflation is settling in at around 3.5%, 4%, PCE is a little lower than CPI for a lot of reasons. And so at 3.5-4% inflation, 2.5% real growth, a 5.5% funds rate is okay, right? They've already told you they're not going to hike rates, right, to try and shorten that timeline of getting to 2%. So if you're the market, you're like, well, that's okay. But I think the key is, and this is Waller and everybody else is pushing in that direction, let the markets figure that out, right? Rather than the Fed imposing that view, let everybody kind of evolve to that position slowly. And then all's okay.
I was pointing out that Waller has been somewhat instrumental because he was the member over the Fed that suggested that, look, we can keep conditions tight for a while without causing casualties for the labor market like other cycles we've seen. This time is a little bit different. You'll just simply see the for hire sign go down out of the window. It won't actually cause a spike in the unemployment rate. So the fact right. that he's now guiding a slightly more hawkish tone than what we've seen before, is that something more significant for the markets than, say, Bostic earlier in the week?
Yes. I think Bostic's an important voice, but I think Waller is much more important. And I think he's sort of considered a bit of the alter ego of Powell. So when he says something, the market should react to it. And look, he's right and he's wrong, right? So how tight is the Fed if the economy is continuing to roll along here and it's not slowing down? At some point, they have to ask themselves the question whether or not their base view, which 50 basis points real is neutral, which means 150 basis points, right, is tight. Now, if you go before the 08-09 recession, neutral was 200 basis points. So we're actually, you know, are we back in that pre-COVID world? Or in a different position? And again, to be fair to the Fed, which I don't have to be, but to be fair to the Fed, they're kind of evolving and they're doing the right thing by not rushing in either direction, right? And it could very well be that the economy just continues to show strength. And as long as inflation doesn't start moving up back up above 4%, they can sit here. And as the markets recognize that the Fed's not trying to get tighter, right? In fact, they're on the side of the market. If there's weakness, they'll cut. If there's no weakness, they'll stay where they are. So if you're the market, it's a bit, you hate to say the put, but it's kind of like a put, at least on the economy. And so I think the markets are right to rally off of that.
And in fact, financial conditions have been easing up a little bit, haven't they, including mortgage rates even in the United States. I was reading a really interesting sort of facts and figures, you know, this day in history kind of thing, where it's said that over the past 35 or so years, of all the seven times that the Fed has started a rate cutting cycle, the markets, with the exception of one time in the 1990s, has actually declined. And I don't mean just like a blip one day, but actually declined to quite a significant degree. And the reason for that was that usually the reason that they've started cutting is because the economy is already in recession or it's on the cusp of a recession. So in other words, to your point, right now, if the economy is resilient, maybe a bit better than expected, and they don't cut, that could be a good thing.
It is a good thing. Look, if they do cut, it's because inflation's lower and they don't want to passively get more restrictive. Right now, inflation's moving the other way, so you're exactly right. It's getting less restrictive. But if you think about it in terms of the politics of it, which we can't avoid this year in the U.S., if they cut rates simply because inflation's lower but the economy's still doing well, the optics of that is that he's part of the committee to reelect Biden, right? So even though we all understand the reason why they're cutting, because inflation's at 3 instead of 4, et cetera, so
they can't wait too long then. They can't
exactly.
wait until just
and
before
that's why the market, and that's why the market is sitting there with a 2/3 probability of a cut in June. Because this kind of cut, they can only do by June, and after June, the window to do that is shut. Now, they'll cut after June if the economy falls apart. But, you know, in that type of adjustment, very difficult. The optics of it make it very difficult after June.
Where does this leave the market? It's been a terrific rally. I think there's no taking away from the breadth that's come into the market, the AI rally, the overall market indice levels we've seen. If we don't get more than one rate cut, and if there's a scenario of none at all, where does it leave the stock market trade?
Still going up. I mean, I don't want to talk about any one stock or another, you know, and not everything is trading at a high multiple. But if I say to you, I've got 2.5% real growth and 3.5% inflation, that inflation is very helpful to margins. Because you've got so many firms, think of this firm, put how much in technology in order just to stay in business, right? And now all of a sudden, your prices are going up, or at least they're not falling anymore. The value of all that past technological investment starts to come right to the bottom line of the business. So firms that have been very stressed on margins over the last, say, 10, 15, 20 years even, start to look a lot better.
But with higher credit costs still, right, for those that haven't refinanced, they're still facing higher interest costs.
Right, and that's why growth is 2.5%, not 4.5%. Right. So, you know, yeah, I mean, it's not, look, it's a very big, diverse economy, and it's a very big country. So you never have all geographic regions in every industry in every corner of the country doing well. There's always leaders, laggards. It's just the nature of the beast, right? So the equity investor's job is to pick out what's doing better, where the value is. But as an economist stepping back, you say, no, there's no reason for the equity market to go down.
Stephen, it's such a treat to see you. Thank you for coming to visit us. And great to catch up with you in person. We'll see you soon down the line again. Stephen Blitz with us, Chief U.S. Economist T.S. Lombard. Now, we've got hawkish central banker commentary from both sides of the pond this morning. Bank of England rate setter Jonathan Haskell says he thinks rate cuts are, quote, a long way off after he shifted his position to a hold from calling for a hike at the MPC's meeting last week. It comes after Governor Andrew Bailey said interest rate cuts are in play amid falling headline inflation. The UK's base rate remains at a 14-year high, with money markets pricing in just under 75 basis points of cuts this year. Arbile.
Thanks, Karen. Well, coming up on the show, Chinese President Xi Jinping striking a collaborative tone on US relations as the Bao Forum continues out of China. Plus, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Cocoa prices surging past $10,000 a ton earlier this week. That's more than double January's level, even more expensive than copper. All of this ahead, of course, of the Easter weekend. And we've got another bumper earnings day ahead for you. Lloyd's Chairman Bruce Carnegie Brown joins us. That's at 8 CET.
Listen to CNBC's Beyond the Valley, the podcast that explores the biggest tech news from across the globe. Join me, Arjun Karpal.
And me, Tom Chitty, every week as we bring you insights into the top stories, unpack the latest trends, and find out where the industry is headed.
Now available on Spotify, Apple Music, and Google Podcasts.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned China against flooding global markets with a glut of heavily subsidized green energy exports. Yellen warned it would risk destabilizing global supply chains of developing industries. The comments come as Xi Jinping met with American CEOs in Beijing and before her own visit next month. Now, President Xi struck a collaborative tone when talking about China's relationship with the United States.
We are conducting exchanges and promoting cooperation, and our activities are injecting positive energy into China-US ties. How are the relations between China and the United States, and whether the two countries are in cooperation or confrontation, bear on the well-being of their two peoples and the future and destiny of mankind? The respective successes of China and the US are opportunities for each other. As long as both sides regard each other as partners, respect each other, live in peace and cooperate for win-win results, China-US relations will become better.
Leaders from across the globe have been meeting at the Boao Forum with financial cooperation, climate change and AI taking center stage. Lin joins us now from the event. Lin, we've had a lot of commentary about the red carpet being rolled out for businesses that China's open for investment. What is the wash-up of this week? How do you think it has played out for the Chinese?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I think it depends on who you ask. Because if you look at some of the businesses like Apple, like Fortescue Metal, I spoke with the CEO, of course, yesterday. They were already heavily invested in China, whether it was the customer base or whether it was supply chains. And they are certainly there to stay. But in some of the conversations that I have had with business executives here at the Boao Forum, they've said to me that there is a level of caution, but also optimism. So they want to see some of these promises that have been made by top officials actually come to effect on a concrete level. And there are also still concerns around that regulatory environment. For example, the tech crackdown. We saw also the gaming crackdown that was, but then sort of wasn't. So those concerns certainly still remain, but they are, you know, there's this optimism about what is coming out. And certainly today we got the keynote address. It was from the third in charge of China, Zhao Lijie. He is the top Chinese legislator behind Xi Jinping and Li Qiang. Now, we didn't get any new announcements out of this speech, but certainly, again, as I said, some pretty positive signals. We are seeing some upside when you look at the mainland indices. In terms of sort of the main points here, one was he was emphasizing that China does not want to decouple. It is against blocks and it doesn't want competition with any countries. In fact, it wants win-win cooperation, and he emphasized particularly the Asia region. The other point he was talking about was China's economy. He said he was confident. He said that 5% GDP target for this year was one of the highest among the major economies, and that will drive global growth. Now, earlier I spoke with the head of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, Jing Li Qing. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
We had, I think, very interesting and productive dialogue between the U.S. and Chinese, we call it business roundtable, but they are not exclusively business people. We have academics, both sides, and I'm a represented international institution. I think more or less the same. How could the United States and China work together to address the common challenge, climate change? How can we deal with the AI era? How could we regulate and by working together? So I think the general sentiment is the American business people, academics, the Chinese counterparts all agree there's great scope for cooperation between the United States and China. And my personal view is, even though the United States is not a member of this bank, we worked very well with the World Bank Group, with the ADB. So this means there are great opportunities for work together to live up to the expectations of our people.
So certainly that is one of the views here at the Boao Forum. Also in this keynote speech, he also spoke about foreign investment yet again. And we are again seeing that push, right? Because we had the China Development Forum, we had Invest China, and now the Boao Forum. And in this speech, he emphasized this point about China reducing that negative list, which is a list that sets out the industries that are restricted from private investment. He also reiterated again that they will remove all the barriers in terms of investment in the manufacturing space, and that they will make it easier for people, foreigners, to come to the country to work, to travel, and to study as well. So that's what the message certainly is coming from Beijing. But I think in terms of what the practical impact will be going forward, that still remains to be seen. Back to you guys,
Absolutely.
Mandy.
It's always a case of talk is cheap, right? You got to walk the talk. But anyway, some progress at least on the talking. Thank you so much. And we'll catch Lin Lin later on. Well, still with China, Chinese smartphone manufacturer Xiaomi will be launching its highly anticipated electric vehicle today, where it will reveal its pricing and start taking orders. Xiaomi announced its foray into EVs about 3 years ago, taking on Tesla and BYD at a time of slower growth in the Chinese market. We'll talk more about this one later. Fascinating story. Well, Chinese President Xi Jinping warning the visiting Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte against decoupling and breaking links with China. It comes after the Netherlands blocked chipmaker ASML from exporting its advanced DUV tool lines to China, with questions now surrounding whether or not The Hague will allow it to service the equipment it's already sold. We're talking about billions of dollars here. She told Ritter that attempts to restrict Beijing's access to technology won't stop the country's development. Well, Ritter said he hoped that restricting access to technology does not impact economic relations with China.
When it is about our semicon sector and companies like ASML, that when we have to take measures, that they are never aimed at one country specific, that we always try to make sure that the impact is limited, is not impacting the supply chain, therefore is not impacting, let's say, the overall economic relationship.
Well, Arjun joins us now on this story. Arjun, I know you've got some very strong thoughts on this.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story because ASML is a critical company in the chip supply chain. They make these ultraviolet lithography machines, which are key for effectively etching designs on chips. And there's two types of these machines that ASML produces. There's the DUV machine, which you mentioned, deep ultraviolet lithography machines. And there's the extreme ultraviolet lithography machines, EUV. These EUV machines are required to make the most cutting-edge chips on the planet in a cost-efficient way with a high yield. Now, there are very few companies, manufacturers, that are using these, TSMC, Samsung, amongst them as well. But China's biggest manufacturer, SMIC, has never been able to get its hands on these machines. However, it has been able to buy these DUV machines, slightly older technology required for producing less advanced chips. Now, when last year the Dutch government brought in new export restrictions, they included restrictions on these DUV machines. And that is a further blow, I think, to China's ambitions to really want to move ahead quickly in terms of producing the most cutting-edge chips in the world.
What about the impact on ASML, though? Because even though it says it hasn't had a major negative impact so far, let's be honest, like, China is its number two customer after Taiwan, and longer term, we might see Chinese chip makers turning away from ASML if they're not a reliable partner and getting their equipment from other players, like, you know, domestic Chinese players or even Japanese players like Nikon or Canon.
That's right. Short term, there hasn't been much of an impact. I think, you know, ASML has never been able to ship an EUV machine to China. It shipped a few of these DUV machines before the export restrictions came out, so you haven't seen a huge impact. But longer term, if it continues, I mean, think China's nearly a third of ASML's revenues. There's a lot at stake here, billions of dollars at stake here for ASML. So the long-term impact could be big. The Japanese players are really the only, at this point, alternative, but not necessarily a viable like-for-like replacement alternative. ASML really is the only company in the world producing these EUV chips. The Japanese are trying to bet on a slightly different technology. So I don't think, even as China looks for alternatives, nothing that can like for like replace the technology that ASML produces.
To me, what was interesting about this conversation was that Xi Jinping was talking to the next potential chief of NATO. Mark Rutter obviously has been floated very much at the forefront as the next incoming NATO head. So the learnings and the conversation here around technology and the sort of edge it can provide, not just around commerce, but also around security, is key. And if we think about the US CHIPS Act, it started with security being front in mind, not just competitive threat from the Chinese. And of course, following laws that have come through in other countries, the likes of the Netherlands, a consequence of that US CHIPS Act. So it was fascinating from that context, right?
It really was. And a lot of the chip conversation, I think, as it's been shown by the US, is exactly that. They're positioning it as a security play, that we don't want China to have access to its technology, which then could go into military applications in particular. The AI advances as well, which again could feed back into military applications. And the US has put immense pressure on the Netherlands for several years to not allow some of these tools to be shipped to China. And you're seeing that bearing fruit now as well. But
and this is basic stuff too. What it was mobile phones, for instance, guiding missiles in Ukraine to help the Russians. That Russians have been ordering, say, these devices out of the Chinese. It was as basic as that, right? Old technology.
It's old technology. And what's been interesting, I think, over the past sort of 6 months or so in China, starting from around September last year, was when Huawei released the new phone, a Mate 60 in China, and it, you know, some of the teardowns by analysts of the device show that it had a 5G chip at a 7-nanometer scale. Now, this is seen as fairly advanced, not the most advanced on the planet, but it showed that China is now able to produce some of the more leading-edge chips with older technology. Now, a lot of it was posturing and marketing because it's unlikely this is happening in a profitable way or in a way that is efficient because they're using older tools. But clearly, China is trying to make a statement on the world stage saying, well, look, we can restrict us, but we're still going to be able to catch up eventually.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market moving news, you can head to CNBC.com or join us again on the show with me, Steve Sedgwick, and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.